You ever read Science magazine? This is Science 84. Must be a sign of old age to have these periodic jerks. Science 84. April 1984. Sorry, Peter. There's an article in this that I believe everybody in the world ought to read. And since I have little faith in everybody reading everything, unlike some people who decry the fact that television has stopped people from reading, I just read to a lot of people on television. I think this subject is important enough that I can just do a little sidetrack tonight. You see, you'll decide. Doctor, I don't even know whether it's Coley or Colley. Dr. Colley's toxins. A Victorian surgeon found that cancer victims who caught an infectious disease sometimes got better. Only now are doctors beginning to take him seriously. Now, many of you know we prayed with Joe Shack, our chief engineer, when his father went in to have a tumor removed through two surgeries. I want you to pray again. You know, our team really stays under attack. They had left a small piece of it because it was so close to a main artery, hoping that radiation could contain it until other arterial growth would make surgery easier. I understand in a matter of days, or at the most another week or two, he'll be going back in for the third surgery now. Cancers are terrible. 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 Fear-inspiring happening. Anything that brings attention to possibilities that help cancer victims, I want to turn the world on to. On Saturday, March 4th, 1967, John Fagan, a longshoreman in Glasgow, Scotland, vomited what his physician, Archibald MacDonald, assumed were the disintegrating remains of his stomach. It gets better. MacDonald expected to sign the death certificate any day. But on Monday, Fagan woke at 6 o'clock and said he was hungry. He ate a boiled egg. By the end of March, Fagan was better. And by late that year, the cancerous mass in his abdomen had totally disappeared. The senior priest at Fagan's church decided to investigate the rumors of a miracle. 2 years earlier, Fagan had had a large part of his stomach and colon removed. When a new mass had appeared in his upper abdomen less than a year later, the last rites were administered by the assistant priest at the Church of Blessed John Ogilvie, which Fagan attended. During the latter part of his illness, Fagan kept with him a medal of Ogilvie, a 16th century Scottish Calvinist turned Jesuit priest, who said Mass at a time when anti-Catholic feelings in Scotland ran high. He was hanged in 1615 for refusing to put his king before God. For many years, there had been a campaign in Glasgow to get Ogilvie canonized, but the essential prerequisite for canonization, a miracle, was lacking. The medical men and theologians explored Fagan's remarkable recovery. They tested and talked and concluded that there was no explanation for Fagan's cure. On February 12, 1976, the Pope issued a decree stating that the recovery was a miracle. And John Ogilvie was canonized at St. Peter's Church in Rome on October 17th. Now, you're going to read that headline, so I'll read it to you. This is a story about a doctor And the headline here says, Coley took the next daring step to try to deliberately infect an inoperable cancer patient. Now you don't have to read it. Listen to me. While a miracle was sufficient explanation for the theologians, it hardly sufficed for the doctors. Usually it doesn't. And yet cases of regression of cancer had been reported in the medical literature for years. Now, do you know the percentage of people that can expect to get cancer before they die? I mean, this is a subject everybody here ought to be interested in. While a miracle was sufficient explanation for the theologians, it hardly sufficed for the doctors, and yet cases of regression of cancer have been reported in the medical literature for years. The best account so far is a comprehensive survey of 176 cases by surgeons T.C. Everson and Warren H. Cole, who demanded microscopic evidence of the cancer. But what caused these remarkable regressions? 176 cases that required microscopic evidence that the cancer was there and it regressed. What caused it? One observation made again and again, now listen close, was that infections go hand in hand with regression. William B. Coley, a surgeon who practiced at New York's Memorial Hospital from 1891 to 1936, concluded from his experience that the connection was a profound one. Now, you could all read this, but most of you don't have access to the magazine. Another large part of you wouldn't read it. I mean, if somebody put it in your hands, you would. But let me read it to you. William B. Coley, a surgeon who practiced in New York... There's not a thing you could say that would stop me. William B. Coley, a surgeon who practiced at New York's Memorial Hospital from 1891 to 1936, concluded from his experience that the connection, infections plus regression of cancer, was a profound one, one that could be exploited, and he put his belief on the line. Coley's first cancer patient was a 19-year-old woman with a malignancy that had spread to the bone. After her arm was amputated, her prognosis seemed reasonably good. When she died shortly thereafter, so much for prognosis, Coley was deeply disheartened, and he began his own personal effort to seek a more effective treatment. He methodically studied the records of all similar cases, about 100, treated in the New York hospital during the preceding 15 years. One in particular aroused his curiosity. It was the case of a man who had been considered untreatable after 4 unsuccessful operations for recurrent cancer of the neck. When his tumors suddenly disappeared without apparent cause, no one could explain why. Coley, however, noticed that before getting better, the man had... Now, I'm not too sure, but what this is a boring subject. Coley, however, noticed that before getting better, the man had. You interested in this subject or not? I mean, I don't want to push it off on you. I just usually think if I'm interested, you are. Because there's nobody quite as smart as us. Which means if you're not interested, I guess you're dumb. Who wants to listen to a dummy anyway? I mean, there are enough of them to be listened to. Since we analyzed that and concluded properly, let's get on with it. Okay? Coley, however, noticed that before getting better, the man had suffered 2 acute attacks of erysipelas, a severe, sometimes fatal skin infection caused by the bacterium Streptococcus pyogenes. determined to find out whether the man was still alive and well, Coley tracked him down. 7 years after his release from the hospital, 4 operations on his neck. A severe attack of a bacterial skin infection. 7 years after his release from the hospital, the man was free of cancer. Since Coley was convinced of a direct link between the infection and the disappearance of the tumors, he took the next daring step to try to induce a regression by deliberately infecting one of his inoperable cancer patients with the same bacterium that causes that skin disease that this other fellow had. To Coley's dismay, the infection didn't take, neither did his subsequent 2 attempts. But from the eminent Berlin microbe hunter Robert Koch, he got a particularly virulent culture of live streptococci that induced severe infection, along with a very high fever. He got it in a patient with an advanced, inoperable cancer of the tonsils and the neck. Inoperable, advanced cancer of the tonsils and neck. From the Berlin microbe hunter, Robert Koch, he got a culture of this bacteria. It took. Within days, the tumor disappeared completely. Coley recognized that using live bacteria might be extremely dangerous for his patients. Hey, this isn't some quack study. You know, this is Science 84, April, the magazine. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Coley recognized that using live bacteria might be extremely dangerous for his patients. How many have come into contact with people who have cancer, either parents, relatives, yourself? Let me see your hands. Well, that tells a story. You ought to be interested. And I think you are. Coley recognized that using live bacteria might be extremely dangerous for his patients. You know, there's no commercial station would read this. Can't afford to talk about things that people are really interested in. They do. They got to chop it up, not read a scientific document. We're not smart enough to just hear a scientific document. We're just people. I wish they'd get that marvelous ad and have that little lady say the television programmers, "Where's the beef?" Send her to these award shows. And after they hand them all out, she gets up and says, "Where's the beef?" And all of you jump up and say, "Westar 5, transponder 1X. Coley recognized that using live bacteria might be extremely dangerous for his patients. So he tried sterilized cultures of the bacteria. None of them worked. Eventually he found that he could safely use a filtered toxin produced by the bacteria combined with the filtered toxin of another bacterium, Bacillus protegiosus, now called Serratia marcescens. It was this preparation, and later the more effective heat kill products that were known as Coley's toxins. Putting together these various filtered and combined bacterium, he produced a toxin. The first patient treated with Coley's toxins had a remarkable recovery. The complete disappearance of a large, inoperable sarcoma of the abdominal wall and pelvis. He remained well until his death from heart disease 26 years later. Coley's first success in curing a child came in 1897. I mean, where's the world been? When a physician from the West Coast brought in his 5-year-old daughter with an inoperable sarcoma of the face that had recurred after prior surgery. After 4 weeks of Coley's treatments, the tumor disappeared completely. Mary Doty is alive and well today, aged 92. Other physicians begin to use Coley's toxins with mixed success. Some preparations worked, some didn't. There was serious variation in their potency, and no one knew whether the best way to administer them was directly into the tumor, intravenously, or intramuscularly. Moreover, all these efforts were uncoordinated, and there was no scientific foundation on which to build hypotheses of why the vaccines succeeded or failed. To this day, no one knows how Coley's toxins work. The variability of Coley's results was not the only obstacle to acceptance of the toxins by the medical community. His work began only 4 years before the discovery of X-rays. So even his most impressive end results were overshadowed by the new technology. Timing is very important in the attention that things receive. In fact, the recognition and honors he subsequently received were primarily for his work as a surgeon. There is special poignancy to the displacement of Coley's therapy by radiation. For it was Coley who in February 1902, as a member of the medical board of Memorial Hospital, insisted that the hospital have a radiation department. And it was Coley who persuaded two of his wealthy patients to pay for the first radiotherapy machine. The medical director of Memorial, C.P. Rhodes, embraced the new therapy with the fervor of the converted, pushing aside Coley's toxins in the process. That I can understand too. New equipment you just turn on versus the toxin product. Coley had seen this coming, but the disappointment and antagonisms wrecked his health. See, in all areas, pioneers must suffer. He died in 1936. Now, not only is this a very vital story that I'm going to go on with, it also illustrates that thing I keep looking for. I think God looks for that uncommon person. Never say die. Won't quit. You know, somebody's going to tell our story someday. Somebody that won't quit until the truth comes out. The battles that we have had for freedom against bureaucratic oppression. Now, that's not the subject tonight, but I'm telling you, you win in any arena by what you're going to see in this story. Coley's insights might well have vanished forever had it not been for his daughter, Helen Knauts. I don't really know how to pronounce it. It's N-A-U-T-S, so I'm just going to say Knauts. Ladies, take heart. His son Bradley, who succeeded Coley as head of Memorial Hospital's bone tumor service, continued to use the toxins on certain bone tumors with success, but he was skeptical of their value in other types of cancer. By the way, it isn't unusual for a son to doubt his father's pioneering effort. That happened in the pyramid studies. The son went down to disprove his father's theories. Thought he did it, but ended up with measurements that proved his father to be right all along. So if it hadn't been for that need of a son to step out from the shadow of a great father in the pyramid studies, we wouldn't have the greatest proof of those measurements that are so vital to the prophetic meaning of the pyramid. But that's not a subject. In 1938, Nautz, his daughter, decided to write her father's biography. And as she read some 15,000 of his letters and papers stored in a family barn in Sharon, Connecticut. Boy, would I like to get in some barns in Connecticut. As she read some 15,000 of his letters and papers stored in, you know how many letters that is? In a family barn in Sharon, Connecticut, she found clues to the rejection of his work. The enormous variations in methods and dosages and the absence of systematic evaluation of the information. In September 1940, she gave the significant data she had culled to her brother, hoping he would take it from there. 4 months went by. She began to realize he would never have time to touch the material. She went to Rhodes at Memorial and told him she thought Coley's work needed re-evaluation. He told her the best way to proceed was to get 100 or so case histories together. She took that advice to heart, eventually producing more than 1,000 case histories. Quote, also went to see Gregory Schwartzman, head of bacteriology at Mount Sinai Hospital, now says. He and Father had corresponded, and Schwartzman was impressed with what Father was doing. I had read Schwartzman's book on the reaction of tumors to bacteria and had prepared 13 pages of questions based on it. During the interview, I took 80 pages of notes. Schwartzman couldn't believe anyone could be that thorough. But because I had no medical education, I had to be that way. So now it's launched on her life's work, and the biography never was written. Without benefit of computers or Xerox machines, she began an investigation that led to all the physicians in the United States and abroad who had ever used Coley's toxins or similar methods. She wrote several thousand letters to patients, their doctors, and hospitals that had used these preparations. She checked to see whether the patients were alive, and if not, to determine the date and cause of death. In 1953, Nautz founded the Cancer Research Institute, an organization committed to research on cancer immunotherapy, the only institution of its kind in the world. Considering that she was regarded as obsessed with an unproven cancer therapy, her institute was organized on impeccably respectable lines. The Scientific Advisory Council reads like a who's who in cancer immunology. Its medical director is Lloyd Old, a distinguished cancer immunologist and vice chairman of the executive committee of the Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research. Nautz was politically astute, realizing that the acceptance of a radical innovation is more probable when presented conservatively. Carefully and methodically, she sifted her data, looking for patterns, trying to find answers to questions. How did the new treatment work? Am I boring you? Which preparations were most effective? How crucial were the stage of the patient's illness, the degree of fever induced, the potency? Somebody fall off of a chair? Anybody fall over there? How crucial were the stage of the patient's illness, the degree of fever induced, the potency of the vaccine used, the site, dose, frequency, and duration of injections? Were certain tumors more sensitive to toxins than others? Answer, they are. Did the toxins enhance the response to other treatments? Answer, they do. Come on, here's some cases. Let's just rest a minute from the heavy stuff. Case number 8, female. She had thousands. Age 12. The patient had been a strong and healthy child until March 1894. She fell and bruised her groin area, which became swollen, causing much distress. The swelling increased gradually. The child lost appetite and strength and was finally confined to bed. Her abdomen continued to increase in size. She became feverish. Her condition became critical. I mean, I've read enough, you know, this is not some funny land operation. Exploratory surgery in July revealed a cancerous growth in the abdominal wall lining, the pelvic organs, and a portion of the intestines. The growth was partly loosened, and a piece as large as a fist was removed. Alarming bleeding and the patient's unfavorable condition made further surgery impossible. The child was taken to a ward in dying condition. Toxin therapy was begun 4 days later. During the next week, dead tumor tissue the size of large oysters was discharged through a drainage tube. The patient began to improve steadily. On September 17th, she went home, the picture of health, with red lips and plump. She was free of cancer 4 years later. You want another one? Case number 44. Male, aged 33. The patient fell ill in December 1907. He suffered from cough and lost 40 pounds in 6 months. Examination of the abdomen revealed an enormous growth which filled the whole abdominal cavity. In May, a solid malignant tumor weighing 13.5 pounds was removed from the right kidney. The patient made a smooth recovery and was discharged on June 26, 1908. The man returned to the hospital on April 17, 1910, with a swelling in the groin the size of an orange. A major portion of the lining of the abdominal cavity was removed. The patient re-entered the hospital 2 months later with growths on the right side of the abdomen. An exploratory incision proved the cancer to be inoperable as too much of the intestines were involved. So Coley's toxins were begun for a total of 41 injections. In 2 months, the tumors had entirely disappeared. The patient was perfectly well 6 years after his last illness. You want another one? I like to read stories that end right. Case number 11. Female, aged 16. The patient had always been in good health. In March 1894, she began to have pain in her left arm and shoulder. She noticed a small tumor in her back over the left scapula, which rapidly increased in size, gradually spreading until it covered half her back and a large portion of her chest. She was in increasing pain, and the tumor interfered with the motion of her arm. The patient was admitted to Memorial Hospital in New York on June 23, 1894, under Dr. W.B. Coley's care. Examination revealed a hard, flat mass, almost 2 inches thick in some places, fixed to the scapula and ribs. The skin over the growth looked normal and did not adhere to it. The young woman could not raise her left arm to a horizontal position because it was bound down by the growth. A biopsy showed the mass to be cancerous. Because of the rapidity of its growth and its enormous extent, Coley did not believe even temporary arrest was possible. Nevertheless, he decided to try toxic injections. They were begun on June 23rd and were given daily on or every other day, producing marked fever, usually accompanied by a chill. To Coley's astonishment, improvement was immediate and rapid. Within 3 weeks, the woman could raise her arm to a vertical position, not just horizontal, vertical. And within a month, the growth in front had nearly disappeared. The improvement continued until the latter part of October, when no trace of tumor could be found. The cancer regressed entirely by absorption without breaking down or sloughing off. The woman remained in good health and free from recurrence when last traced 19 years after the onset. I like good news. Now it's devoted a great deal. Can I go on?
Yes, sir.
Nauch devoted a great deal of her time to editing and correlating the case histories of 896 patients with microscopically confirmed cancers. Now that's my kind of research. I mean, not the healing of Angela's kind that... And I believe in healing. But there are just lots of people that claim to be healed. There's no proof they had it. I don't take anything away from their own experience. Nor do I deny divine healing. I believe in it. But research to convince has got to do this kind of in-depth stuff. Will somebody climb on the roof and see what's the matter with the air conditioning? Nauch devoted a great deal of her time to editing and correlating the case histories of 896 patients with microscopically confirmed cancers. 428. Prior to her work, the best that had been done was a 176 case survey. 428 who recovered dramatically treated with Coley's toxins. This editing and correlating of case histories has been published in 18 volumes. She has been asked to lecture. Boy, that's uncommon quality work. She has been asked to lecture at 10 international cancer conferences in 5 countries. She maintains a correspondence network between 3,200 physicians and researchers in 67 countries who are interested in cancer immunology. Am I boring you? Still intensely active in the field, Helen Nauch looks at least 10 years younger than her 76 years. She has consistently kept a low profile, shunning publicity. Her feelings about this near half century of work are mixed. An unfortunate combination of circumstances, rather than a conspiracy, she says, kept Coley's toxins on the sidelines all these years. That's why I'm bringing them out. Just thank God for the magazine article. Thank God for the university network that can take the time to read it. First, here's the unusual combination of circumstances. First, the eclipse of father's discovery by the sudden impact of radiation therapy. Second, the variability of the vaccines and the lack of knowledge of the best techniques for administering them. Remember, he died in 1936. And third, the total ignorance of how they worked. These unfortunate combination of circumstances, with that primary importance of radiation, kept his toxins on the sidelines. But, she says, what made me really angry was that just as more physicians were beginning to use Coley's toxins, Congress in 1962 passed the Kefauver Act, and the Food and Drug Administration designated the toxins a new drug, although they'd been in use for 70 years. Let's hear it for the bureaucrats. A new drug that had been in use for 70 years. This entailed so much red tape once it was designated by the FDA as a new drug. It entailed so much red tape to get permission to use it that physicians were naturally discouraged from using it. And the final blow came when the American Cancer Society in 1965 put Coley's toxins on their list of unproven remedies, which over the years has included scores of such dubious entries as Laetrile, mistletoe, orgone energy devices, ultraviolet blood irradiation, and Zen macrobiotic diets. Guilt by association. While Coley's toxins were removed, that's why I don't ever want to be put in the category of a television evangelist. I mean, anytime I read in any newspaper they call me a television evangelist, I know that I've not been researched. I ain't one. While Coley's toxins were removed from the index in 1975, big deal, they are still used only experimentally, so at least they were moved off of the dubious remedy list. But they're used only experimentally. Physicians wanting to use mixed bacterial vaccines, as Coley's toxins are now called, must in some cases still obtain an investigational new drug license from the Food and Drug Administration. And do you know what that takes? Only a handful of physicians, for all of these reasons, in the United States are currently using the vaccines. Now, you better listen close, folks, because you may want to go call on these doctors. A few of them that have fought through the red tape to use them. Isaac Gerasi, D.J., Isaac Gerasi, Director of Research at Mercy Catholic Medical Center, Philadelphia, PA, is one. If I ever get cancer, Philadelphia, here I come. He is currently testing mixed bacterial vaccines on cancer patients to determine if the vaccines are safe and without serious side effects. They seem to be. But just what mechanisms are at work when Coley's toxins induce regression of cancer? Do the vaccines stimulate the immune system of the body by provoking it to produce anti-cancer substances like interferon? Do they jolt the body's scavengers, the macrophages, into better action, or do they modify or enhance the tumor's antigens so that the immune system suddenly recognizes the tumor cells as foreign invaders that must be destroyed? In short, what about the bacteria, mixed bacteria injection? Why and how does it work? At Sloan Kettering, old, now he was on her advisory list. In fact, the medical director of the Scientific Advisory Council, Lloyd Old, cancer immunologist and vice chairman of the Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research. At Sloan Kettering, Old has isolated in mice who receive mixed bacterial vaccines a tumor-killing factor, which appears to work by damaging the tumor's blood vessels while leaving normal blood vessels alone. It also may be toxic to the cancer cells themselves. Microbiologist Sam... Am I boring you?
No, sir.
No, you know. You got to listen to this a little more than soap opera bed hopping. You only need eyeballs for that. You need a brain for this. Microbiologist Samuel Barron has recently begun testing the vaccines on mice at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. That's here for Texas. Barron has spent the last 2 years using a variety of Streptococcus strains to stimulate the production of a naturally occurring anti-cancer protein called gamma interferon. When tumor-bearing mice are injected with gamma interferon, a few that would have died don't. Some do not die as quickly, and some have delayed tumor growth. Now, Douglas Wygent at Barron's department has found that Coley's toxin are powerful inducers of gamma interferon. What's more, Barron may have isolated the agent in Coley's toxins that produce the anti-cancer effect, protein M. Now, what makes me want to cry is the number of years that passed before this kind of experimentation was going on. In fact, if Jesus told Oral Roberts he was going to discover the cure, I hope he's reading his magazine. Somebody discover it. Other researchers are pursuing the role of fever in Coley's toxins. The toxin seems to work best when a high fever, upwards of 105 degrees Fahrenheit, is induced, which makes sense since cancer cells succumb to heat more readily than do normal cells. Physiologist Charles Dinarello and oncologist James Muir and David Parkinson at the New England Medical Center in Boston think they may have clues to the biological mechanism in fever that protects against tumor cells. The body produces a protein that causes fever, and this protein may also stimulate the immune system of the body. The fever-producing protein may have another anti-cancer action. It may restrict the circulation of iron through the body and selectively starve the cancer cells whose requirement for iron is higher than normal cells. Nouts, the daughter, meanwhile, is continually answering questions about the vaccines from doctors both here and abroad. In October 1983, she traveled to China for 2 weeks with Gerasi and H. Francis Hobbes, a microbiologist at Temple University School of Medicine in Philadelphia who has done animal testing with the vaccines. They were invited by physicians in Beijing and Shanghai to lecture and discuss plans for vaccine clinical trials. In Beijing, their host was Guo Zarin, with apologies for my Chinese, Associate Director of Pediatric Oncology and Attending Surgeon at Beijing Children's Hospital, the largest pediatric hospital in the world. Guo and Nouts had been corresponding for 2 years, and she had sent him the formula for the vaccines. Guo had already produced some interesting results with them. Complete disappearance of extensive inoperable cancers in two young children who are now well almost 2 years later, and a recent dramatic regression of a massive abdominal tumor in an 18-month-old baby, a terminal case. Guo will soon begin using mixed bacterial vaccines on a broad scale. He expects to treat 100 pediatric cancers annually. Currently, mixed bacterial vaccines are undergoing a clinical trial at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, directed by cancer immunologist Herbert Oetjen and oncologist Sanford Kempen. Since 1976, some 60 seriously ill patients, all with nodular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer of the lymph glands, have been given chemotherapy. All receive the same treatment, chemotherapy, but half chosen at random also receive injections of the vaccine. Back to that question, do the toxins enhance response to other treatments? Since 1976, some 60 seriously ill patients, all with nodular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer of the lymph glands, have been given chemotherapy. All receive the same chemotherapy treatment, but half, chosen at random, also receive injections of the bacterial vaccines. Those who get chemotherapy plus the vaccines have had a longer survival rate than the others. I wonder what would have happened if they'd have had the vaccines without the chemotherapy. But at least those who get it, the vaccines plus chemotherapy, have had a longer survival rate than the others. In the 8 years since the trial began, 3 patients have died in this group getting both chemotherapy and vaccine, while 9 have died in the group receiving chemotherapy alone. Well, that's 3 times. But the researchers will make no prediction about the efficacy of the vaccine until progress of both groups of patients is monitored for some time. I guess all 60 die. But that's still the kind of research that needs to be done. Until those and other results are in, however, most doctors are likely to remain skeptical about Coley's toxins. Most people remain skeptical about anything they don't know. And that includes the medical community. They only have 24 hours in a day? And they sleep and eat and play, sometimes more than other people. They're mortals. They don't know everything. We put too big a burden on doctors. We expect them to know everything. After a while, they believe they should. And dare not hint that they don't, with few very intelligent exceptions. The modern medical community, Oetjen says, has a hard time accepting turn-of-the-century anecdotes as valid evidence. Another researcher says everything Helen Nautz has shown is true, but it's all history. Nonetheless, her half-century of patience and hard work is finally beginning to pay off. But, Nautz says, I think we have to recognize the success is not going to come just from Coley's vaccine or from any single therapy or from any one magic thing. There's got to be a knowledge of how you can combine the best and use them in tandem. If she didn't say that, we'd be another 70 years getting anybody looking at it. Dr. Coley would have undoubtedly been pleased. For what he suspected, the intimate connection between bacteria and the regression of cancer is at least being taken seriously at last. I thought you'd like to hear that article. Science, April 1984, American Association for the Advancement of Science. Science 84 is published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science to bridge the distance between science and citizen. Published. The address, 1515 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C. Well, one good thing coming out of Washington. Subscription, office in Des Moines, Iowa. And a long list of the editorial advisory board. $2. And I don't sell it. I'm sure you're glad you heard it. Now let's go back to English history. I was reading last night a book, The Story of the Britons, published in 1903, written by Hubert M. Skinner, PhD, out of print, published in Chicago, I guess, originally. Amazing how little we've been taught about English history. Flip on back, musicians. Amazing how little we've been taught about a lot of things. Now, to quickly catch it up, we followed the trail of Brute last night. The founder of Britain. You can still find his landing place at Totnes in England. In fact, If Craig Lamp went there and didn't take a good picture, may he totter the rest of his days. That strange chapter in Genesis where Judah and Tamar produced twins. Zara, whose hand comes out of the womb first, and since the law of primogeniture is involved, firstborn having right of inheritance by birth. And by the way, it's much that same rule in a more modern form that caused the English gentry to go around the world, because the sons that followed the firstborn had to seek their fortune elsewhere. The patterns dating down through the centuries. A debate was immediately engendered by that midwife when she placed that piece of thread around the wrist of Zara as he came forth from that tomb. Forever the debate would rage among the sons of Judah, who was the firstborn. Zara's hand came forth, was withdrawn. Pharaoh's, the firstborn, didn't have the string around his wrist, and Zara's fullborn second. The problem is compounded when the prophecy of Jacob in the Old Testament for his sons gives all the birthright to Joseph's sons that he had adopted, except for two things: the right of scepter or kingship and the right of lawmaking. Those two he gave to Judah. Now the problem compounds. Who receives the right given to Judah? It's not until David becomes king of the Pharaoh's line that God focuses another promise, another covenant, and gives to David the right to rule over all of his people Israel. But in the very prophecy itself, where Nathan comes to David, he indicates that Israel, ruled over by David, will be in a place other than where they are. They're already in the Holy Land. And he establishes a perpetual dynasty, the house of David, of the Judah line through Pharaoh's. But until that happened, if you were born of the Zara line, you'd question the right for Judah to have it all. The sons of Zara go down into Egypt, or, as some scholars think, maybe they didn't all go, but some of them did. Diodorus of Sicily speaks of two exodus out of Egypt. The shepherd kings, Hyksos, foreign rulers, shepherd kings usually translated, have always been a mystery since Herodotus named them. Manetho, the Egyptian equivalent of Herodotus as the ancient historian, the priest in Egypt, who wrote for them as Herodotus wrote for the Greeks, called them foreign rulers who came in and came to the throne to rule Egypt without a battle. Egypt's always been Upper and Lower Egypt. If you see ancient pictures of the Pharaoh, the color of their hat determined whether they ruled Upper or Lower or both kingdoms. Joseph, obviously, when you strip the fantasy of Sunday school off and read the Bible as it reads, became the ruler all over Egypt. Whether he took the Pharaoh title or not, or his successor, brethren, and descendants did, is irrelevant. He was the ruler. He owned the land, he owned the cattle, he owned the money, he owned the people, and moved them around like serfs. He settled his brethren in the best territory. Exodus simply says a Pharaoh rose up who knew not Joseph. History records Upper Egypt rebelled and threw the foreign rulers out. Diodorus of Sicily has two exoduses, as I've said. One that left by sea, the other that left with Moses. The ordinary people stayed became slaves some 40 to 50 years before Moses' birth, at the most 100 years. Rulers, as always, left. The sons of Zarah were among those pushing for rulership. One of the sons, Dardanus, founded Troy. Another son founded Athens. And it was these foreign rulers from Egypt who came to rule and brought the culture of Egypt to its high status. Lots of people do not know those beautiful monuments in Greece are lined up to astronomy as Stonehenge and the pyramid is. That brings up another subject, doesn't it? And one we haven't talked about. We haven't even gotten to Easter Island yet, have we? We haven't even gotten to the pyramid. We haven't even touched the pyramids in South America. You know, there's so much evidence for Atlantis in South America that some even try to move it. That's another subject. The founders of Troy and the founders of the Greek city-states came from Egypt. Cyrus Gordon has shown the common root from which the Hebraic culture and the Greek cultures grew. Homer was considered myth. Homer wrote the Iliad, the siege and the destruction of Troy, ending with the death of Hector. Odyssey is the return of the Grecian heroes. Virgil, the great Latin poet, writing in Augustus Caesar's day, wrote the Aeneid, which is the story of Aeneas, son of the brother of Priam, king of Troy, married to the daughter of Priam, king of Troy, both of them of the line of Dardanus, of the line of Zarah, of the line of Judah, of the line of Israel, of the line of Isaac, of the line of Abraham. Virgil's poem traces Aeneas, the descendant of Zarah, who leaves Troy with his aged father on his shoulder or on his back. His wife will be lost in the escape. His young son by the hand. His trip to Carthage, then to Italy, where he is promised the daughter of the king of the Latins, who is also promised to the king of a tribe in Italy. They engage in battle. Aeneas wins. His son, in turn, has a son named Brute, who kills his father in a hunting accident, is banished. Aeneas fled, ultimately to land in Italy, married to the daughter of the Latin king. They will father Romulus, legendary founder of Rome. Well, now, Homer was always considered legend, so everything else is legend. But Schliemann sort of suggested that Homer may have a basis in fact. Now that adds a potential factual foundation to Aeneas, Virgil's work. Geoffrey of Monmouth picks up the story when the son, banished for the accidental death of his father, who was the son of Aeneas, Brute being the grandson, flees back to Greece, organizes a slave rebellion, liberates the Trojan slaves, and in some 400 ships sets sail westward again, retracing the path of Aeneas. Arrives in Spain. Interestingly enough, nobody ever asked, why is Zaragoza named Zaragoza? Why is the Iberian Peninsula named Iberian Peninsula? You ever think of that? Abiru. The Hebrew. I was born in Idaho. You used to tell a story about how Boise got named. It's almost as stupid as that Amazing Grace song, Oh Beautiful Sea, at the end. And then they used to tell it when I was a boy. bunch of mountain men came over the hill and saw the valley where Boise is, and one of them says, "Boise!" It's awful. It's just awful, terrible. I'm telling you, Iberia didn't get his name from a beer drinker. Abiru. Hebrews. Did you ever ask questions like that? He went on to land at Totnes to found New Troy. It's amazing how much art and music and English literature has picked up on this. And we took the tracing of Brute's descendants up to Bladud last night, who came to the throne. His most significant accomplishment to make him memorable, he's the father of Lear, famous the world over as the hero of the great tragedy of Shakespeare. Lear reigned during a period of peace and prosperity. He had no son to succeed him, 3 daughters. He asked them to tell him how much they loved him. That's where we were last night. The 2 oldest daughters overdid it because they didn't love him. The youngest daughter told him the truth, didn't flatter him enough. He banished her without a dowry. He then put his 2 eldest daughters on the throne, divided the kingdom. He kept only a royal guard. Then they turned out to be what they really were. What's funny about that? It was arranged. I'm skipping. See, I'm trying to go past where I ended last night. It was arranged that the king, after his abdication, should retain his title while he should live, and that with his retinue of 100 knights, he should live alternately with the 2 eldest daughters, Goneril and Regan. The 2 elder daughters, when they had secured from their aged father his power and wealth, broke their promises, treated him with heartless meanness, compelled him to discharge his bodyguard, which was all that was left to remind him of his days as a king. Finding life unendurable with them, he turned to Cordelia, whom he had treated with such injustice, banished her without a dowry to be married in Gaul. Cordelia, when she learned that her father had arrived in Gaul, wept bitterly to learn of his wretched condition. That's where it was last night, only about 4 words further. And at once sent to him a guard of honor with a supply of money and of royal apparel. He was then received at court in a manner becoming his dignity, and an army was immediately raised to reestablish him upon his throne. The invasion of Britain was successful. The old king lived to reign for 3 years more, and when he died, Cordelia succeeded to the throne. She prepared for her father a singular burial place under the bed of the river in the city of Leicester, which he had builded, and which had been originally named Caer Lir, later the Leicester of the Saxons. Cordelia did not remain long in power, but was overthrown by her 2 nephews, who cast her into prison. Unable to endure her sorrow, she took her own life. Read like the book of Judges. Took her own life in her cell, and the unworthy nephew, Cunadagius, having overthrown his cousin Morgan, reigned alone. Now you that know Shakespeare know his drama was built around this. He embellished it a bit. I'll skip over that drama because all of you know Shakespeare, except to say it's in the line of the descendants of Brute. Rivallo, the son of Cunadagius, that unworthy nephew of Cordelia that took over the throne, succeeded Cunadagius to the throne of the Britons. In his time, it was averred that red rain of blood fell from the heaven. The people were frightened at this awful visitation. The singular storm did not abate like an ordinary rain. For 3 days and 3 nights together, the horrible flood continued until pools of blood were everywhere found in the hollows of the land. The pools turned to sickening corruption and thousands of people died. Now, it'd be interesting to timeline this with some other happenings. If the strange prodigies related by the Britons were like those of other nations, it'd be easy to claim they were borrowed from the folklore of the world, but the rain of blood in the heaven in Revallo's day, like the speaking of the eagles in the times of Lyle, seems to be peculiarly British. Am I boring you? You got to catch. You don't want me to review it all. I want to get on to Constantius. Let's skip along. Gergustius followed Revallo, then Cecilius, then Jago, the nephew of the latter, then Kenmarcus, and later his son Gorbogudo, or Gorboduc. The last name, Gorboduc, is the subject, we skipped along there, is the subject of the first tragedy written in the English language. How come we didn't know that in our English courses? They had taught me this kind of stuff, I'd liked English. The first tragedy written in the English language is about Gorboduc. Now everybody ought to know about Gorboduc. Don't know how I lived so long I didn't find out about Gorboduc. How come nobody names their kids Gorboduc? You realize there are a lot of names other than John, Peter, and Paul. David, Tom, and Stephen. Nothing wrong with those names. But you know, for a people that are destined to equal stars and sand, you need to have some sources for some new names. I haven't heard anybody called Gorboduc in a long, long time. In fact, come think of it, I don't ever remember anybody named Gorboduc. Now, my dad never did like Theodore. He liked to be called Ted. Well, now, he's listening right now. Dad, you can be glad you weren't named Gorboduc. Or what his name was before it became Gorboduc, which was Gorbogudo. You know, it would be hard to talk pillow talk to Gorboduc, wouldn't it? This tragedy, the first one ever written in English language, was once very famous and is still read with interest by many students of literature, though it's not now played in theaters. Come on. If it ain't Westwood, I'm telling you, it ain't playing. The family of the king was not a happy one. He had two sons, Ferrex and Porrex. You know, I haven't heard any kids named Ferrex and Porrex very long. Porrex, is that a soup or a cleansing agent? He had two sons, Ferrex and Porrex. Ferrex, Porrex, you get over here to dinner. I wouldn't name a dog that. He had two sons, Ferrex and Porrex, both of whom were ambitious to succeed him. The queen, whose name was Viden or Widen, let's make it a different kind of eye, Whedon, was devoted to Ferrex, who appears to have been less ambitious than his brother. Both princes seemed to be impatient of the long rule of their father. They gave him no rest until he divided his kingdom between them. Okay, Ferrex and Porrex, we're going to divide it up now. This act appears not to have been a voluntary one, for some say that the sons had imprisoned Gorboduc. At all events, he was shorn of his power in the kingdom. The monster of ambition gained complete possession of the heart of Porrex. He even plotted the assassination of his brother. The latter, Ferrex, through a friend, became aware of the design against his life, made good his escape across the channel. He was kindly received by Suard, the king of the Gauls. Suard soon led an army into Britain to assert the rights of the exiled Ferrex. But the Gauls were no match for Porrex, who utterly defeated and scattered the invaders in a single battle, and Ferrex was among the slain. Queen Viden was aroused to madness at the death of her favorite son. Probably her own life wasn't saved. At all events, she determined upon a terrible vengeance against the unlimited power of Porrex. She matched her cunning. Don't ever get a woman cunningly plotting against you. son. Just know this, they're cunning. She seems to have taken none of the soldiers or officers into her confidence. Indeed, it would appear that she didn't communicate her plan to any man. I'm telling you, I teach all the time. Even women can learn from what I teach. She secured the cooperation of some women of the court whom she could trust implicitly. Now, come on, women. Can you really trust another woman? I mean to tell you, Gloria said, "Yes, sir." In fact, that's one of the few times she's addressed her pastor in a manner that I would tremble to disagree. I mean, she said that like she meant it, didn't she? I mean, when a story... let's go on. Then when a favorable opportunity came, she succeeded in stealing into the chamber where the king lay asleep. That's it, men. You don't dare sleep where a woman is around. It's just that simple. Don't go to sleep with a woman. Do anything else you want to do, just don't sleep with her. What I said. For me, I go to bed with everybody nationwide every night, but I don't sleep with women. I play it safe. I ain't going to ask any of the rest of you. Why are you all looking so strange? It says right here where the king lay asleep. Her women accompanied her and were well on. You realize that king had a bedroom full of women and he is sleeping? The damn fool deserved to be killed. Ain't that boring? Sure was for the king. The infuriated mother buried an axe in the brain of the youth as he slept. I told you, don't ever sleep with a woman in the room. You say, that's awful. Well, how about that poor guy, Jael, or whatever the heck his name was? He went to sleep in a tent with a woman in the book of Judges. She drove a nail through his head, nailed his whole head to the floor. Don't sleep with women. Don't ever say I didn't tell you. When you get to heaven, and you're headless. Am I boring you? I think I am. I don't think I want to finish this story. I think I want to hear if I'm boring you. I'm not going to read any more till I'm caught. How many of you men are sleeping with some woman right now? You better by cracky wake up. Better, far better, listen to me than get an axe in your head.